This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yahya Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is the first African summit that is taking place, that is countries are discussing climate change, particularly in Africa. And this comes at a time that the world is also preparing for COP28 in the United Arab Emirates in the coming months.
That's reporter Mohamed Yusuf in Nairobi closely monitoring the African climate summit. Details coming up also. The leaders of the coup that ousted Gabonese President Ali Bongo was sworn in today. And Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa was sworn in for a second term in office. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story as thousands of people danced and sang in a packed stadium in Harare as Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa took the oath of office for a second time. In his speech, he hailed last month's election as a sign of the country's mature democracy and a victory over Western adversaries. He also called for national unity and said he is the president for all. Both Western and African observers questioned the election's fairness. Opposition activists have called it a fraud. Reporter Kudzaza Nwashi is in Harare, spoke with people in the capital about the inauguration.
A few kilometers from the arena, where Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa took the oath for a second term, people in Harare's central business district are going about their business. Some civil society groups and opposition parties say the elections last month were a sham. Building up to the inauguration, critics warned the opposition might try to stop or delay the inauguration by approaching the courts. However, there has been no court filing. Watson Jere is a vendor in Harare's central business district.
So those people in Harare, they are complaining. They are saying that the president rigged the elections. The people, they are not happy. Because if you can see, those supporters, they get the supporters from out, from rural areas. The bus is for free. They mustn't not do that. The people must come on their own.
Tendai Miko is a Harare resident who attended the inauguration.
We are in full support of his infrastructure development, which is a key fundamental area in any economic development growth.
William Farai also approves of Mnangagwa, who leads the ZANU-PF, which has dominated Zimbabwe's government since independence in 1980.
I, as a Zimbabwean, I don't have a query with that, because what I know and what I remember, I was born in this ruling party. My grandfather, grandmother, and great-grandfather, they were in the fight. They fought for this land for us to be free like we are today. So, as my side, as an individual, I don't have a problem with that. Let him be. The inauguration is going on.
The Zimbabwe Election Commission declared Mnangagwa the winner of the August 23 election with about 53% of the vote. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe in Harare, Zimbabwe.
The leader of the coup that ousted Gabonese President Ali Bongo was sworn in Monday amid international calls for a return to a constitutional order. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited Bitam, a town in northern Gabon near the border with Cameroon, to gauge people's moods and files this report.
The scores of people in Bitam watch Gabon's national television broadcasting the inauguration of General Brice Oligui Nguema as interim president. Bitam is a commercial town in the north of Gabon near the Cameroonian border. During a ceremony attended by politicians, diplomats, clerics, the military, and a huge crowd of civilians, the military leader pledged to respect what he called the charter of the transitional government. He gave no details. Among the civilians watching the ceremony in Bitam was local official and opposition supporter Pierre-Marie Changa. Changa said he was not surprised that opposition presidential candidate Albert Ondo-Osa did not attend the inauguration ceremony. He says Gabon's military should not think that the ongoing excitement is because civilians love General Brice Oligui Nguema, who has seized power. He says civilians are happy that Ali Bongo has been toppled, putting an end to his family's close to 60-year grip on power. The 69-year-old Ondo also did not attend a meeting between the transitional president and opposition party leaders on Friday. Ondo said he wants to discuss the future of Gabon with the general in the absence of other opposition members and close aides to the military leader.
Concernant la situation, moi je souhaite...
Changa said the new leader should bring honor to himself and Gabon's civilians by making sure the results of August 26 elections are processed, made public, and the winner inaugurated as president in the shortest possible period of time. Changa said this should not exceed 6 months. Gabon's main opposition group, Alternance 2023, asserts that the 69-year-old Ondo, a former government minister and university professor, is the rightful winner of the August 26 election. On Friday, Alternance 2023 urged the international community to ask the junta to hand power to Ondo. The African Union and the Economic Community of Central African States last week called for a rapid return to constitutional order. Gabon was suspended from the African Union following the coup, which the UN and France have condemned. The AU said it will impose further sanctions on the coup leaders if they do not restore constitutional order. Mba Dominic is an international affairs analyst at Omar Bongo University in Libreville, the capital of Gabon. Dominique says calls by the AU, ECAS, and Gabon's neighbors Cameroon, Chad, and Equatorial Guinea for Gabon's military leaders to hand over to civilians are like cries in the wilderness. He says similar calls for the military juntas in Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Guinea to relinquish power or be punished have had no effect. The transitional leader takes over from Ali Bongo, who came to power in 2009 following the death of his father, Omar, who had led the Central African country since 1967. Gabon's opposition says the family ruled with an iron fist and confiscated most of the oil-producing nation's wealth. The general said Monday that he will be transparent in his leadership and render an account of his stewardship. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bitam, Northern Gabon.
The African Climate Summit has opened in Nairobi, Kenya, with heads of state and others asserting a stronger voice on a global issue that affects the continent of 1.3 billion people. Reporter Mohammed Yusuf is closely monitoring the summit in Nairobi. I talked to him a little while ago.
This is the first African summit that is taking place, that is, countries are discussing climate change, particularly in Africa. And this comes at a time that the world is also preparing for COP28 in the United Arab Emirates in the coming months. So Africa, particularly governments, officials, international organizations are trying to use this summit to come up with solutions. And one of it is going green transition, and also the issue of financing that I've been talking about for the past few years. That has been a debate that has been raging. But at the opening ceremony today, Kenyan President, the host country, Kenyan President William Ruto, spoke about now people who are here should be looking at policies, not discussing the problems, but should be looking for solutions. And of course, as always, there will be criticism on how the developed countries, with their development, the impact it's having globally, particularly Africa, which has been devastated with floods, droughts, persistent that has been going on in Eastern Africa. There have been migrations. People have been moving out from their homes because of harsh climate conditions. There have also been Africans who are migrating to European countries, crossing the Mediterranean and many other oceans. So that has been the problems many Africans have been facing. And now the debate now is also the issue how now Africa can handle this climate crisis and how it can combat it.
So more than a dozen heads of states are expected to attend this summit. And outside attendees to the summit include the U.S. government's climate envoy, John Kerry, and the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who has said he will address finance as one of the burning injustices of the climate crisis.
The issue of finance has been a problem coming out from Paris agreement in France back in 2016, 2017. Countries pledged, the world pledged about 100 billion per year that it will be supporting to combat the climate change adaptation, mitigation, and building also resilience. And there have been a lot of complaints, and many reports of many people have been close to these issues have been saying that they've been receiving about 10% or sometimes even less. So 10% is about 10 billion. And if you look at the global GDP for the year 2023, we're talking of $105 trillion. And what countries or the world are expected to contribute is about 100 billion. And that is something that many African countries have been trying to talk about. But as they also do, we understand that some of these finances, if it's provided as it is, or that becomes quite clear, for example, countries, they're able to get 100 billion, then they're able to solve some of these problems, particularly starting from the communities, communities that have been ravaged by droughts, trying to build resilience, communities that have been losing their livestock, areas that have been flooded, areas that have been people moving out. Some of these communities, such kind of money can really empower them and stop the migrations, the violence, the diseases, and the hunger that's taking place in those areas. But that hasn't been forthcoming, and this is something now African countries are really, really pushing as they prepare for the COP28. And as they also say, this time around, Africa also wants to see what it can bring on the table to as part of solution.
So Ruto made his way to today's event in a small electric car, a contrast to the usual government convoys on streets. Talk to us a little about Ruto's small electric car, the symbolism.
Yes, it is. And as a president, since he came into power last year, he has been pushing for this energy transition, particularly one key area that he has been launching for the past few weeks or months has been transition motorbikes. Just a few years ago, they have been talking of phasing out these big cars, bringing small cars for the ministers, government officials, but that hasn't been happening.
That was our reporter, Mohamed Yusuf in Nairobi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. After meeting Russian President Vladimir Putin today, Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan said he thinks a solution can be found soon to revive the UN-brokered Black Sea grain export deal. Turkey hopes to convince Russia to return to the agreement after Moscow withdrew in July, ending a year of exports from Ukrainian ports despite the war there. Putin also said Moscow was close to a deal to send free Russian grain to six African countries. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has contributed to grain shortages in many countries. A New World Food Program report says up to 2.5 million additional people in Sudan are expected to slip into hunger in the coming months due to ongoing violence. WFP, the World Food Program, also is concerned that the conflict could undermine the current planting season as farmers face insecurity and struggle to cope with soaring prices of fertilizer and seeds. Lenny Kinsley is communications officer for the World Food Program in Sudan. As the fighting in Sudan escalates and spreads throughout the country, she tells me that over 20 million people in Sudan currently face hunger and do not know where their next meal is coming from.
So things in Port Sudan are a bit challenging. You have a lot of influx of people displaced who are trying to leave the country from Port Sudan. And we're seeing that all across the country. We now have some hubs, operational hubs set up in Kosti, which is in White Nile State, in Wad Madani, Jazeera State, to try to support as many people who have fled the intense fighting in Khartoum as possible. We're seeing people fleeing by the day, and we're seeing the fighting escalate and spread across the country, which is extremely concerning because humanitarian needs and food insecurity in Sudan were already at record levels before the conflict started in April. And now, at the beginning of the conflict, we were warning that additional 2.5 million people could be pushed into hunger. And a recent assessment that was issued just a few weeks ago at the beginning of this month showed that it's actually even worse than that. So right now we're looking at over 20 million people who do not know where their next meal would come from, who are facing hunger. And what is most concerning about this is that around 6.3 million people, it's 12.5% of the population, are just one step away from famine. And that is emergency levels of hunger. People are selling off what they own just to afford a meal a day. And we're seeing this particularly in the Darfurs, but also in the Kordofans and parts of Red Sea State. So,
and Lini, also WFP is assisting newly arrived refugees with emergency food assistance in neighboring countries. How is that going along?
Yes, so we're also providing assistance on the border in Chad, as well as in Egypt and Rank in South Sudan. And it's extremely challenging because these countries were already, at least their operations in those countries, were already facing funding deficits before. And so it's a challenge. In Egypt, luckily for Sudanese refugees, we started up a cash assistance program and also providing different kinds of food like date bars in Chad. Also some cotton ready-to-eat meals on the border. But with the number of refugees and Sudanese who are going into neighboring countries.
And now you say 2.5 million additional people in Sudan are expected to slip into hunger. This thing is getting bigger by the day. Can WFP handle this?
So basically what we had been warning about at the beginning of the crisis has now been confirmed. And yes, it is growing and it has been growing year on year. For the past several years. And this has been an extremely concerning trend, mostly due to economic downturn, intercommunal conflict, which existed before this broader nationwide conflict, but also climate shocks, droughts, and floods. So there are a lot of factors that are playing into why food insecurity is getting so high. And to your question, whether or more organizations should be involved, it's not necessarily a matter of more organizations, but the international community and donors, one, need to step up to provide WFP and other organizations that are working on the humanitarian response in Sudan with additional funding to be able to do so. But it is also very, very much about having the ability to be able to deliver, and that's tied to insecurity and access constraints. And so much more needs to be done in this regard to urge all parties to the conflict to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance, to protect humanitarian workers, assistance, assets, premises, and offices. And this is where the international community could push further and be more aligned in order to support humanitarian efforts in the country that are going on so that WFP can scale up and reach as many of the people as possible who need this assistance.
That was Lenny Kinsley, Communications Officer for the World Food Program in Sudan. She talked with me from Nairobi. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says an inquiry has found no evidence to support allegations that his government supplied arms and ammunition to Russia for its forces to use in Ukraine. In May, the United States ambassador to South Africa said that according to U.S. intelligence, weapons were loaded onto a Russian vessel at a naval base near Cape Town last December. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa's governing African National Congress has faced intense criticism for its friendliness toward Russian President Vladimir Putin's government since it invaded Ukraine in February 2022. South Africa is one of only a few nations that has abstained from United Nations votes on the conflict, refusing to publicly condemn Russia. The ANC insists it's neutral, but Ramaphosa has committed his administration to closer military cooperation with Russia. His government's also allowing sanctioned Russian vessels and aircraft to dock and land in South Africa. Ramaphosa gave a televised address to the nation last night about the claims that a Russian ship, the Lady R, was secretly loaded with weapons in December. The allegations were first made by U.S. Ambassador to Pretoria, Ruben Brigati. Ramaphosa said people who claimed to have evidence that his administration was secretly supplying weapons to Moscow backtracked when approached by an independent panel of legal experts.
More than 100 documents were submitted to the panel for examination. A number of entities and persons that had publicly claimed to have information on this matter were invited to make submissions to the panel. Many of those invited either failed to do so or said they had no independent knowledge of the relevant facts.
But one of those called to give evidence, Democratic Alliance Member of Parliament Quibus Mare, says the process wasn't fair and transparent.
Then I asked them, what is your terms of reference? I need to know what you must investigate so that I can decide on what information I must provide you. They were not prepared to do that. Then I asked them, if I provide you information and testimony, will I be able to check the correctness of only the portion that deals with the evidence that I will be giving? And they said, no, they can't do that.
Mare agrees that no weapons were loaded onto the Russian ship. He says his sources say South Africa secretly provided Moscow with components of weapons. If the panel had investigated this, says Mare, its findings could have looked very different. Sales of weapon components to Russia is a violation of international sanctions against Moscow. It also contravenes South African law prohibiting supply of military material to states engaged in actions that could contribute to escalation of regional conflicts. Ramaphosa says he considers the matter to be closed. His administration says it won't release the panel's full report as it contains details that could damage state security. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Eritrean migrants who were involved in bloody skirmishes on the streets of Tel Aviv should be deported immediately. The Prime Minister says he has also ordered a plan to remove all African migrants from Israel. Violent clashes broke out Saturday between supporters of the opponents of Eritrea's government and the East African country's authoritarian leader, President Isaias Afwerki. The confrontation occurred at a pro-Eritrean event at Eritrea's embassy. Israel police used stun grenades to control the crowds, and protesters responded by hurling stones at police. Israel's emergency service said at least 114 people were injured, while Israeli police said 27 officers were hurt. About 20,000 Eritrean asylum seekers live in Israel. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.